Okay, thank you, bro. We've got just about an hour, so if anybody would like to ask any questions, make any points. Simon first, off the block.
Last night I wasn't writing off the internet, I'm just saying that, you know, the capitalists have had like 20 years to digest it and they've done a damn good job on something that they saw at the time to be indigestible. But to the matter of class consciousness, I think what I'd say is, you may remember in the 1980s, and this is before sort of like, you know, computers and computer games became more current, you had like the adventure game, the adventure books, you know, the do your own adventure, you know, the book where you are the hero. Now, I think that's a very good way of looking at how people live in the world, that, you know, they are in a world in which everyone is the hero of their own adventure. They are, you know, in their own world. Now, our assumption is usually that there is a world that all of us are in, and we can say, well, I think this way about the world, so I can just talk to someone else, and they will see it in the same way as I do, because I've transferred the same information to them, and they're in my world, so they will see it the same way, and we're all lined up, you know, got our ducks in a row, and away we go to the revolution, okay? Because I've got the right information, I give it to them, they've got the right information. However, if you look at people as basically being in their own worlds, yeah, and inhabiting them, looking at the world in a different way, yeah, then that's just not working. Yeah? Because you're talking to someone and they're not hearing what you're saying, because they're taking what you're saying, but they're trying to put it into their world and try and make it make sense to them. And it's just not. So what you find is you get affinity groups developed of people who people are able to talk to each other, because they've got like close circumstances now, so they basically form effectively cults, if you will. So like they all think the same way, looking at the world the same way. But you're only ever going to draw that small number of people who look at the world in that way. However, if what you do is you try and enable people to live in their own world, to sort of make their own world flesh, if you will, yeah, that works. Because you're not saying to people, here's capitalism, it does it this way, yeah? Therefore, sort of like, we should do it that way. You're not making a statement of, like, yeah, we have the same world, we should do this. Instead, what we're saying is that, you know, there's sort of like the Marxist quote of, like, you know, you are nothing and should be everything, you know, sort of like, you, whatever your world is, whatever it is that you want to be, do that, if that makes sense. No?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure I can answer it, though. I kept with you for about 10 minutes last night, and but I thought I was doing quite well.
Are you all right on that one?
I suppose the only thing I would say is, I think what you're saying is predicated on the fact that things aren't going the right direction and things aren't happening or aren't happening quick enough. I think I would disagree with that. That, yes, if we look around us, if we look at the party membership and any sort of measurement of working class political consciousness like that, then, you know, it's going in the wrong direction. But I think under the surface, under the radar, I think things are going in the right direction. It's not because of the Socialist Party's activities, of course. It's simply because of the problems that capitalism is throwing up. I really do think working class are getting far more politically aware for a whole host of reasons. I won't go into them because I think you want to come back.
Just briefly, do you want to clarify here?
I would say, just look at what the working class actually is and actually does today. What do we and our friends spend most of our time doing? It's fiction, you know. I mean, what Bill was talking about yesterday to me about disidentification, I think it is. Like, someone goes to work, even when they work 8 hours a day or whatever, they don't see themselves as a person who works. They say, I'm a struggling artist, you know, or I'm a struggling busker or something like that. Yeah, I just happen to have to do 8 hours a day working. Yeah? People don't see themselves as workers, even when they're at work. Yeah, we all live in our own various like fictional environments. Like, oh, I can't wait till I get home to watch Game of Thrones or Towie or whatever it is that someone's doing. We don't have this unitary look at the world that may or may not have been a fiction even in the 19th century, but is certainly a fiction in the 21st. So what you need to do is, instead of saying we are all in this one world and we can look at it all together and like change it in this way, we can't do that because people aren't starting from the right starting points. However, if you just say, yeah, So whatever your world is, yeah, you are being disconfirmed by capitalism. You know, you are not able to do this. While you're in capitalism, this will remain a fiction. Yeah? However, this is how you want your world to turn out. This is what you want to be able to do. Yeah? Argue for a world where whatever it is that you want to do, you can do. Now, some of these people, as I said, you may not like what they want to do. You know, some of it, maybe they've been watching too many series of Dexter or something, you know. But whatever it is, that is a different approach. Rather than saying, this is what socialism is, yeah, you say, it's basically, it is the world in which you are the hero. Yeah.
I suppose my only comment on that would be that I think throughout our history we have been tiny, and I suppose the question is how do we get bigger? But when we do get bigger, my model of how things would be is there'd be lots of diverse examinations of how socialism might happen, and people in their own groups. And yes, you're right, people have focused far too much on the workplace and that sort of thing, and people don't identify, I think, in the way that they might have done 30, 40 years ago with their workplace. They identify through all sorts of other things. And they'd then be looking at how they could use the opportunities that socialism would give them. So, you know, we're only suggesting a framework, and we're a bit bigger and more diverse. We'd be doing all sorts. We wouldn't all be sitting in one room listening to one speaker. We'd be sitting in 100 rooms talking about 100 different sort of aspects of socialism. So, I don't know, I don't quite see the problem that you're challenging. You know, we don't give a sort of monolithic view of socialism. We don't say very much about socialism at all. And I think when we do start saying, describing and articulating socialism, we'll be engaging with people allowing these ideas to flourish.
Okay, Bill?
I think there's two interesting contemporary processes or events going on. I think I seem to match up to what you're saying quite interestingly. First is that Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour Party. Now, everyone's going on about the, you know, how it's the end of the world and he's this manic, far-left candidate. But on closer examination, you look at his actual policies and they're extraordinarily modest. You know, he wants the Bank of England to invest in production. I mean, you know, it's this tiny, you know, really nothing changes. In fact, he's basically, as far as I can see, he's Harold Wilson warmed up. You know, that's how far the Labour Party, this Overton window, I think you say, has moved. But what's interesting about him is how a lot of his campaign, especially among younger people, has taken off on Twitter and on Facebook and through the social media. And although, you know, they had this Blairite fixer saying, you know, the MPs let him on the ballot are morons, as all other people point out, there was a lot of pressure coming on MPs to get him on the ballot paper from members of the party saying we want him on the ballot paper and you know, getting in touch through social media to their MPs. So that, you know, they were aware that they couldn't just quietly, you know, do what they used to do, just fix the election centrally and keep him out. But the fact that he is so basically not that radical, but the fact that he has even slight difference to what's going on and a slight chance of being able to effect some sort of change means that people are piling in, and he, you know, has now got to the point where he's a plausible winner. And likewise, I think the SNP in Scotland, from what I can see, the reason why their vote is now so massive and substantial is because it looked like they were going to do something. They looked like they were winning. It was an effective way of using your time and political activity to join in. So, I mean, this comes back to the old argument for us about critical mass. At the point at which we look like we're going somewhere, people will all pile in. But until then, how do we get them to all pile in?
Yep. And I think the part of our debate with Lenin is just the sort of numbers he uses. He was saying, we just need one, and then we'll get the 99 to pile in. Now, we're not saying you need to have 100 right at the start. It's a process, but we're just saying you need to have more than one. You need to have maybe not a majority, but a significant minority would be sufficient to really start to gather pace. I think the SNP thing that you mentioned, I think it's very interesting actually, because most of my adult life, politics has been on a downward. Every year has been more depressing. There's been less of interest, and last year in Scotland, There's a lot of different things were going on, but people were definitely enervated and energised by it. Quite literally, I would talk politics with my neighbour over the metaphorical garden fence. We were doing that, and people in the street were talking to each other. And in my workplace, people were talking who'd never previously done it. It was acceptable to talk about politics, it was really quite refreshing. And obviously, the thing with SNP is they're just not the Labour Party. They're just hoovering up all that votes, and Corbyn is just not the usual sort of Labour Party
suit
is the word I'm looking for. Thank you, Chairman. I think what is clear is you see more clearly just how the media are trying to control things. They did it with Ed Miliband. No sooner was he in than he was Red Ed, and really just sending warning signals across his bows, saying, "No, if you don't behave really, really well, we're going to go absolutely to town on you." And so when he loses the election and resigns, they're straight in there instantly. This is their chance to make sure they don't get any slightly left-wing leader of the Labour Party. And, Fleet Street is running scared at the moment with the polling figures for Jeremy Corbyn. So the front page of every newspaper is just slamming him at every opportunity they can. So they're definitely running scared, in the same way that the SNP were vilified before the referendum. You kind of see the establishment and the state start to worry, and you think, what are you worried about? As you say, there's nothing here for you to worry about. If I was a capitalist, I'd want people like Jeremy Corbyn as MP, because that's the way of making people think that there's diversity, and he'll keep the show going, he'll keep the profits running.
Okay, coming in at the back, sorry, I don't know your name.
James.
Oh, hello.
Peasants. You mentioned peasants in as much as that he didn't really see that they existed anymore, a mobile phone, or you're implying that because of sort of material benefits a lot of people have today, that they doesn't equate with an idea of peasantry anymore, and that landless peasants. That's what being a peasant really is, I think, today. To be landless, at the whim of told where to go, homelessness as issues, housing. And I just, don't tell me that we're not peasants, because we are. It's like this idea that some of the, or looking in terms of class, working class, someone was telling me, I think it was Fran there, who was telling me that people were, we're not working class, we're middle class. Ideas of confusion of what we are, people who are, oppressed, screwed by the system as it is. I don't know, I don't understand where you got that sort of the peasantry thing. I mean, being a peasant isn't about wearing a smock, chewing on a piece of straw with a flack of cider. I think we are very much peasants today, and I very much like Dick Jackson, the YouTube presenter, and his mad political humour, who does a lot of things to highlight social situations in the political sense. So he's very much a nihilist, and I like what he spoke about the landless peasants. He actually created a landless peasants party as a publicity education tool, not as a real political platform for parliamentary change or anything like that. Yeah, peasants. When I hear that word, I really identify with being a peasant. And I think maybe in the feudal system, peasants actually had a better time of it, because maybe there was a better understanding between them and the gentry, the aristocracy of the land, of actually understanding the land and not abusing the land to the degree that it is today under corporate monstrosity of economics, blah, 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 rape of the earth, minus consumerism, yada yada. Maybe there was more understanding in the old peasant gentry feudal system. I'll sort of stop rabbiting on now. But yeah, you got me going with the peasant idea. Thank you very much.
maybe it was more a throwaway line, really. Certainly, I just want to say that I don't think any group whether they're landless peasants or members of the precariat or workers, wage workers, are beyond our reach, are incapable of getting our ideas, I think, in a way that a peasant in the 1870s in Russia, who, as I said, really had a horizon that was measured in miles, if that, that was couldn't read or couldn't write, and was obviously ingrained with a very strong peasant culture of religion and obedience to the Tsar. Sure, there'll be peasant communities around the world which are not dissimilar to that now, but things have changed very significantly, surely. But I guess my point was that I think there's no group that's beyond reach, whereas the Leninist left would write off whole sections of the world's population and say we're no interest in them. They will follow us. They will follow orders when the time comes.
Okay, Mike.
Up until about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, we very rarely heard the word capitalism used in the mainstream media. But I've noticed that, especially since the economic downturn, and maybe the Occupy movement had some influence on it as well, you do hear the word capitalism cropping up a bit more in newspapers and on television news. And all right, that might be a sloppily defined use of the word, and it's often used in that sort of 1980s greed is good type of stereotype of capitalism. But at least the word is out there. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on whether or not that impacts on political consciousness, if people are at least more aware of a term than maybe people were, say, in the 90s, where I don't remember hearing sort of the word capitalism used quite so often in the mainstream media. So I was just wondering if you thought that... Or if you don't sort of recognise that as a phenomenon, or if you think that could be something that could be latched onto in terms of trying to promote revolutionary political consciousness, in that it sort of opens a door to dialogue with people that maybe might be worth opening and going through, because I think as well you mentioned about. One thing we should do more is talk more about socialism, but of course you need sort of capitalism to compare against it, to some extent at least. So I was just wondering if you thought that that maybe sort of the increased use of the word capitalism in sort of the mainstream circles has any relevance or ramifications for political consciousness.
Yes, I think it does, and I think you're right to highlight this increased use of the word capitalism. I think we don't have many measures to use to establish working class consciousness and awareness of their conditions, but I think that's one that looks to me to be a fairly good indicator that people are kind of calling a spade a spade. The party had a debate about 20 years or so ago about should we stop talking about capitalism and talk about the business world or something like that. There was a group that set up and thought our propaganda was using old-fashioned language, and I think we were right to actually, with hindsight, we were right to just stick with that language, and the fashion sort of comes back round again. But I think it's more than a fashion. I think it is, these words actually mean something, and the fact that these words are being bandied around much more suggests people are more interested in this. They've actually recognised that there is something in this term capitalism. A lot of the time when they're using it, they are using it, as you said, in a sort of maybe not entirely accurately, but I think, yes, I think for me the key thing is it then begs the question, well, capitalism, so post-capitalism or some alternative to it. What the right wing and defenders of capitalism want us to do is start talking about, oh, the problem is crony capitalism. So they're trying to create this sort of idea that actually, all these problems we've had with bankers' crises and credit crunches and such like, this is because there's been too much regulation, and there's these big corporate groups, the banks and such like, they've hived off too much of themselves, and we want to challenge this cronyism, and what we need is more free market capitalism. So it's interesting how people are using this language in slightly different ways, and I just think we should be using the language, and it begs the question, well, what are you going to put in its place? And that's kind of, that's what we do. We do talk about socialism. It's unfortunate that the whole of the left seem immune. They seem to have a resistance to at all talking about some sort of alternative. Having said that, the point I was going to make in the talk, but I cut it out at the last minute, I do think the left are slightly moving this way as well. It seems signs that they are starting to talk about some post-capitalist society. But invariably, these things, when you actually examine them, they're very disappointing. So there was a thing 10 years ago, participatory economics, that sounded all fancy and highfalutin, and you examined it. It was just the most dismal-sounding version of capitalism. Obviously, the Zeitgeist movement's been discussed a lot, but it's, you know, it's interesting that this has bubbled up over the last few years, the Occupy movement. And I mentioned this guy, Paul Mason, you know, a sort of well-respected economics editor in the media, and he's brought out this book, Post-Capitalism. From what I can understand about it, there's, you know, what he means by post-capitalism has quite a lot of bits of capitalism in it, but he is also talking about, very much talking about sort of non-market aspects as well. He thinks the two things can coexist, as they do at the moment, and as things develop, hopefully the non-market element will increase a bit. But there still needs, obviously, to be, this is not a slow process, there still needs to be some sort of actual political challenge and political revolution as well. So I think it's interesting that people are talking about these things. I think it is a measure that things are going in the right way for us in that sense. And we can feel like we're knocking our heads against a brick wall. But I do think in terms of workers' understanding of, so for example, geopolitics, we used to have to tell workers that wars are caused by different capitalist groupings chasing after strategic routes and mineral resources and all the rest of it. We don't need to tell them that now. They know that. Any war that comes up, it's immediately on the news or after this bit of oil or what's going on here. People in my workplace, they know more about, you know, so the lifting of the sanctions on Iran, well, that's in order so they can get access to the Iranian oil, so they can put more oil in the market, so they can, you know, there's all sorts of levels of geopolitics that's going on. I don't think 25 years ago workers were aware of these things to the same extent. So I feel very optimistic. I think things are bubbling under the radar. Things are definitely going our way. What the working class don't have is some sort of political vehicle to express this in. And as soon as something comes along that seems a little bit like better than what they had in the past, like the SNP in Scotland, they launch at it. That's not going to hold. That's not going to stay like that for very much longer, obviously. But they're looking for some sort of political expression.
Anybody else? Well, while you're mulling things over, if I could just add a rambling comment. I was just reminded when Brian was talking of that comment that Marx made about ruling ideas in society being the ideas of the ruling class. And so in normal circumstances, whatever they are, that it's not surprising that most of us won't have a socialist consciousness. But he said something as well, I think, in the German ideology about how it's only through the process of revolution that people's consciousness changes, that they cast off the muck of ages and so on. But you were talking about the left as well, and I think one of the differences with us is that they see sort of revolution more as an event, and the event then sparks off the consciousness, whereas we're more about consciousness changing as a process, are we? I don't know, it's not very coherent here, sorry, but those are the thoughts that came into my head.
I guess the main divide between us and most of the left is they say, let's seize some of the power and then drag the workers behind us. And in the process of doing that, something mystical will happen. They don't really, as I said in the talk, they don't really flesh that out in great detail. It's a similar model, I think, to the anarchists in some ways as well. They see the activity, the act of resisting oppression in any shape or form, it has to be a good thing from their point of view. And most of the time it will be a good thing that we would feel positive about, we would encourage, but not necessarily always. But they, you know, for the anarchist, you know, the process is the thing, isn't it? It kind of leaves me cold, to be honest. I do try and engage with these ideas, and I have done. I just feel the more I look at it, it just kind of leaves me cold. I think what workers need isn't so much action, isn't going out and knocking their head against a brick wall, it isn't chasing reforms, it's actually just standing back and looking at the situation. I used an analogy before you know, if a fire starts in the waste bucket here, you put it out, and there's another fire over there, you try and firefight that and put out, and another one over there, but there's a guy standing there with a petrol can and a box of matches. Well, that's the problem there. Rather than firefighting, you try and deal with the actual problem itself. And I do think the left is slowly heading that way. It's, first of all, it's declining, but more rapidly than we are. Fewer people are coming into them, and they're getting out quicker as well. So they're in significant decline. And I think because their model just isn't working. And I have to say, I think ours hasn't really been tried in comparison.
Simon?
Yeah, I sort of think about what you're saying about getting workers to socialism, etc. And it strikes me that one of our main problems about socialism is socialism. Now, one of the things that situationists did is that they said there's no situationism. You know, we're situationists, but you know, there's no no solidification of it. Now, I think that's the problem. As soon as we start saying that what we want you to think is not what you're thinking, but it's this thing over here, then you lose everyone, yeah? Apart from people who were already thinking the thing that is over here. Now, think of it as cattle rustling, because we're trying to get workers away from capitalists. Yeah? So all these cows mooching around a field. Now, you can go along and try and cattle rustle individual cattle. You try to pull them away with groups of like, you know, sort of lead them off with visions of a pasture in the future or whatever it is, or you could just stand at the back of them and yell stampede and fire off a couple of gunshots and let them trample over the fences and get out. Okay, that is the sort of like post-capitalist instead of socialist revolution. You just say right, okay, get everyone out of the capitalist field. Yeah? Then when everyone's running around, you find out what kind of post-capitalist herd you're going to get. You know.
Thank you. Just to clarify, the Socialist Party doesn't regard our fellow workers as cows. They're definitely sheep, not cows. No, sorry, they're neither. No. Anybody else, please?
But more acceptable allusion will be inserted later.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, anybody else? Brian?
Yeah, can you say something about Marxist socialism? Because when I was a student, there was all these very rabid Marxists who were, sort of followers of Althusser and whatnot. And what I found interesting, as the years have passed, actually, as it were, there's and you've got it with Habermas and the critical theorists, of trying to say, well, of having a kind of market socialism. In other words, trying to have a socialism where it brings in what they call the civil society, as well, the emphasis on democracy in replacement, having much more of a cooperative, and kind of combining a kind of emphasis on cooperation, democracy and whatnot, but really keeping capitalism, but referring to it as the market, and you like that. And it's interesting when you read Melanie Klein. Is it Melanie Klein? No, that's friend of mine. Naomi Klein. Like, when you read Naomi Klein, which is really anti-capitalist, so when you come down to it and really what she really stands for, actually it's this kind of market socialism. It's a kind of benign capitalism, you know? She's not really anti-capitalist at all, that Naomi Klein, when you look at it. I mean, she's in the tradition of somebody like John Dewey or something like that, you know. But I just want your thoughts on this, trying to find a way between these, in fact, keeping the market at the same time, pretending it's socialism.
Yeah,
doesn't that just conceptualise the on the road to socialism, the rift between the evolutionary and revolutionary socialists?
I guess, to try and answer this first question, for me, it's kind of the litmus test, really, is that plenty of people are anti-capitalist, but what is it they're proposing? And so many of these anti-capitalists, when you actually look at it, it's a bit disappointing what they're proposing. And I just see that that they lack confidence in the basic ideas of socialism. They're just not prepared. Some of them may know these ideas, but they just don't think it's that they need to be talking about it, that there's some halfway house that you can reach, that then maybe in some future stage you move on to full-blown socialism. None of these things, again, they kind of leave me cold, because I tend to think that where you have the market, it kind of pushes things out. It abhors a vacuum. How do you balance the market against some sort of civil society? you have to put in all sorts of checks and barriers and regulations. I mean, we know in capitalism we have these things already, and the market usually finds its way around it in some shape or form, and then you have to put some another regulation, another barrier, and then it finds its way around that loophole again. It's you know, the market is a vibrant, flexible thing. It's chasing profit. It has a motive. It has a drive there. And I think you're always leaving yourself open to problems if you're conceiving of a society which is going to have a bit of the market in there in some shape or form.
Vince.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Brian would like to comment on the impression that not just I get, but probably quite a lot of us here and other people get about the idea of politics being a dirty word. And by that I mean that if you start talking about political issues, even if they're not specifically related to socialist party politics, many people will shuffle a little bit, become rather embarrassed, and not really want to talk about it. I'd give you an example. I'm a member of a U3A group which looks at economics. Now, you couldn't get a subject much more closely linked with politics than that. And if I try to inject a little bit of socialist analysis to what's going on in the capitalist world, the group organiser will turn around and saying and say you're being political there, you know, as if that's going to court some support from some of the other group members. And I would like Brian, perhaps if he can, to comment and when politics became a little bit risque and a little bit dodgy to talk about. Has it just been over the last 20 or 30 years? When was a time, if there ever was one, when it was more acceptable to be political and talk about politics?
I suppose on that last question first, I suppose in my experience, I think in the sort of heyday of the left wing and you know, campaign against Thatcher and all the rest of it, politics was kind of ever present. But I think it's since the left wing has sort of lost its mojo, as it were, partly, possibly since the fall of the Soviet Union, that's removed this sort of political, this binary sort of framework for political discussions. And it means the left wing has not really had any objective other than to be defensive and to be reactive and to resist the encroachments of capital. So there's not been a sort of, to the same extent that there was, a sort of easy compass for political debates. Now, you know, that's good in lots of ways. Obviously, the Soviet Union collapsed from our point of view, but it's you know, hemorrhaged the left wing, and it's maybe removed a sort of, as I said, an easy framework in which people could talk about politics. So I guess I think when the left wing started to lose its confidence and the right wing could almost start saying, oh, politics is a dirty word, don't talk politics, it's just business as usual, because that obviously suits the people who at the time are in power and in charge. They're quite happy to not have political discussions. But on your first point, that's why I thought the referendum last year in Scotland was refreshing and interesting, because for years and years politics has been a dirty word, and as you say, people look down to their feet and are embarrassed shuffling when anyone talks politics. But that kind of changed in a matter of a few weeks, and I don't claim to still quite understand all the processes that were going on there, but it certainly did happen, and politics it was acceptable to talk to anybody about politics for a few weeks anyway. So these things can change quite quickly.
Bill?
Jim Yutoki said that Uncle Charlie Marx didn't really talk about political consciousness. But if I recall it, I mean, his 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, or whatever it is, that seems like, if I recall, that is the one where he did talk very largely about it. And it also brings us back to our friend about peasants, because that was the one where he said that the peasants couldn't act as a class in a political sense, because they were all so isolated and an individual. But of course, that I think that's possibly close to where you're saying that things have changed, because now if they have mobile phones, they're no longer isolated into rural idiocy or whatever the phrase was. I thought I'd just mention it. You know, if anyone wants to go do further reading, that book is there, and it's possibly a copy available. Who knows?
You're politely telling me to go and do further reading. it's a long time since I've read it. Yes, you're right. I was aware when I was saying Marx didn't say much about this. So he's probably said more than I've read. I think given the breadth of the subjects that he touched on, and given the centrality to sort of his sort of model for revolution as well, not just ours, it just seems surprising that there's not... But I think there's a reason why not much is said about it. It's quite difficult to get a handle on what is actually meant there. You reminded me that we're sort of just talking about peasants, but also there have been peasant-type political movements in the last sort of 20, 30 years, landless peasants and farmers' movements, very radical in South America and Southeast Asia as well. So... That's all I know about it, but it's not. There are these developments, so it's not all sort of going one way. So these are obviously positive things as well.
Okay, still time if anybody would like to comment or question, or sing a song, tell a joke. Right, you all want to go, don't you? Admit it. Right, I think that's it then. Nobody else wants to speak. Thanks very much to Brian. Excellent talk.
Thank you very much.